as well. So I'm going to do that this morning. I do want to tell you one little story that I learned for the first time this morning. Many of you will know Will Hahn in the other hour and something of what that family has been through this year. I did not know that Will was one of the reenactors for the Jamestown landing celebration this week. The way the story came to me, they had armor for the reenactors to wear, but the armor wouldn't fit Will. So they gave Will the cross to carry, and Will is the one who planted the cross in the reenactment. And he saw that as a connection with Diana and some of the things that have been happening. And there has been at least some evidence of some significant changes in his life just this week, and that sort of crowned it all. So Linda was very very moved in the first hour and shared a little bit of that with us. Now, we have been working for several weeks on the second of our lists in this long list section, characteristics of Jesus. I don't think there's any visitors here, so I won't take the time to set all the preliminaries I sometimes do. But I do want to say that if you look at this through my eyes anyway, something really special is happening in this little set of three. What we did last week, there were some surprises, and I want to make sure that I at least touch base on those surprises. Some things that we're working on today, I think, will add to that. And there's a culmination of what we will do, God willing, next week on this one. So as we go, goodness, and then faith, and then meekness, that there's some very special, I think, a little bit unexpected things that are in this part. Now, what I'd like to do first is I'd like to have you look up 1 Corinthians chapter 4. I want us to read the first verse. And in that verse, I want us to all agree on the meaning of one particular word. And then when we finish that, we'll go ahead and do the part that we're moving towards as a focus. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1. People should think of us as Christ's servants. Us. It could refer to Paul and a few of the leaders, but it could also refer to what? All the Christians in that place or all the Christians in other places. Which do you think is the meaning of that term? I think it's all as well. So I want to read it now with that understanding. People should think of us, that is, God's children, those who are responding to His call, as Christ's servants, as stewards entrusted with the mysteries of God. In such a manner, what is expected of stewards is that each one should be found faithful. One translation says trustworthy. I don't know if there are any other translations to that last word. The subject of the morning is faith or faithfulness, and probably closer to faithful or faithfulness as the characteristic that we're working on. He uses the word steward there, and another word for that might be the third letter in my brother's title. His title is CPA. The A stands for?
Accountant.
Okay, so steward, Mike, there's a little bit more to that term than just this, but an accountant might be something of that order. What's expected of stewards or accounting? It says faithfulness or trustworthiness. But what's really meant by that? You got to be a good accountant. You got to be a good steward. What needs to be there?
Integrity.
Okay. Because I think those are the terms that start to fill this column. If you pick carefully, if you pick correctly. So. Integrity.
Honesty. Reliability.
And we could say honest, we could say reliable as variations on this.
Ethical.
Trustworthy. Yeah, and that's one of the two translations.
take the word ethical. We had a school teacher in the first hour. Whenever her students would do something that was wrong, she would correct them, and their response would be, "You've got kids, some of you." Well, if it was you, and everybody knew it was you, what's the response?
He made me do it.
But there's a bigger one.
He started it.
Okay, he started it.
Okay.
Okay. Here's what my school teacher friend said. She said, "Everybody's doing it." You like that one? Everybody's doing it. Okay? Or, what's maybe worse, nobody will know.
All right,
it doesn't matter. Nobody will know. Who cares? Now, I don't know that all of these fit here. Some of them might fit better over here. Each week we've been working on the picture that this comes from, remember, is the Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus talked about the narrow way that leads to life that very few people find. And you can fall off on one side, Satan's trying to pull you to the opposites. If that doesn't work, Satan may try to push you past this into a conversion. So some of these might fit one place, some of these might fit another. But this begins to sort of the kind of excuses over here as opposed to I think if you're going to have an accountant, you certainly ought to have accountability, don't you?
I couldn't do it, so I would say knowledge if you were an accountant. My son is. He didn't get it from me.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we work on that just a tiny little bit more. There has to be a seeking of knowledge so that one can be trustworthy with that knowledge. Have you ever read, if I can work at seeking of appropriate knowledge. Have you ever read one of the financial reports that the big banks or one of the big industries puts out? They'll have a place where the accountants give their report. And either at the front or the back, they have this, it amounts to really a disclaimer. Have you read those things? It'll say, based on the evidence we were given, to the best of our understanding of current accounting practice, this is a trustworthy and reputable result. And so there is some responsibility that the accountant has. I know when I've talked to my brother a little bit, sometimes when he's got some report to give, he flies to some place and he takes a look at the inventory that they're claiming in depreciated stock or something like that. He'll go look at the inventory because if he hasn't put his eyeball on it, he can't sign off that it's out there or that it's in the condition that, you know, he may not be able to do that perfectly.
Openness and flexibility.
Okay. You're a steward, too.
Yeah, now, I'm going to put a little star on that one because there's more that I'm going to do with that. Let me move over here for just a minute. On the one hand, you've got honest, trustworthy, ethical, right? And then over here, you've got, it's not my fault, he made me do it. He started it. Everybody's doing it. All these other excuses, right? Can you find a perversion that matches all of this into this and back out?
Legalistic.
It's all my fault. Legalist over response.
I'm looking at something slightly different from that. T.W. Hunt, remember I told you these 3 weeks are the most interesting ones to me because he's making me think about things I hadn't thought about before. Look at this in a religious context, right? I've done something wrong. What should I do? I should confess it to God. I do something else wrong. What should I do? I should confess it to God.
And so I'm always working to make sure I've confessed everything I've done wrong. I'm really careful about doing that, so that the eternal books are always balanced off. Everything I've done wrong, I've got a confession checked off. You know, I've got something in this column I've done wrong, I've got a check mark in this column, I've confessed that. And so
what we did in the first hour, sort of working through this, I'm going to give you the benefits of that because I want some time to do some other things a little later, is confession without contrition. Confession without contrition. Now, everything's my fault, the sort of martyr complex. When I start writing faster, it gets worse. The martyr complex, that's probably another piece of this. But the idea that I'm scrupulous about making sure that I've confessed up to date, but I never notice how long that list of confessions is, and I never start looking underneath it. Why am I confessing? Why are these things there? And the kind of wrestling that might be necessary to bring me back to here doesn't happen. But that was a very interesting thing for him to suggest. Yes, Pam?
I think in society in general, we have a way of rationalizing that what is wrong is not so wrong, and we can tend to rationalize that into making it in that middle category and not realizing. I mean, we kind of are going through that with our middle school daughters. They can turn something that is a black and white issue into a very gray issue with just a twist of a couple words.
Rationalization.
And we as adults do it as well.
Yeah, and I don't know that I'm ready to flesh out what it is. There's a difference between rationalizing on this side and rationalizing on that side. So if you're going to call it type 1 and type 2 or type A and type B. But you're sitting there saying, well, you know, I'm on average, I'm honest. And I don't know that I've worded that particularly well, but I think there's some of that's going to show up over here if you start really pulling that apart, and some of it's going to show over there. But it's always an attempt. So I think if you go in with one of the things that Travis Collins said this morning in a different context is hypocrisy. That you want to appear this way, but there's a reality that's something a little different. Over here, you don't care whether you appear that way or not. Every man for himself might fall over here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And trying to think of where that fit. I think that was the reason I put the star on here for consistency. If you've got a terrific stubbornness, and I forget what the word I had a modifier for that in the first hour, and I don't remember, but bullheaded, that was the word. Bullheaded stubbornness. Oh yeah, I know about that one. You can look consistent and still not be much good. And then if you bring that over here, you can be consistently wishy-washy and line those up maybe that way.
Would a perversion be someone who is so legalistic that they deny grace?
And in fact, that term is one that he used.
That's mercy. Think of it, because you mentioned earlier the overzealous about appearing, making sure that.
Now, I want to take you to one term that T.W. Hunt uses. If those of you, if there are those of you who have the workbook, you may have seen this particular one. He puts a word, and I'm going to look for one of Kendall's other colors. He puts in a word, overcommitted. Isn't that an interesting thing to add to that list?
Over, how would overcommitted fall there? He says, workaholic. Religiously workaholic.
Well, that reminds me of when you said martyr complex, there's another term called the savior complex when you think that it's my responsibility to make other people get things right too, and you can, by being that there's a link there with being overcommitted, if you feel like I'm obliged to help and I'm obliged to
what if I really
fix
am?
People.
Sorry, what if I really am? I got a new job a year and a half ago. It's not fun. What leads to people being overcommitted? And let's use a church situation so that one leads to people being overcommitted.
Can't say no.
Uh-huh. Oh, I think sometimes it's very much the, I'm going to keep saying yes to help balance out all the bad or wrong things I've done.
What might be. Might be. It's going to lead to burnout. Yeah. Well, let's say it hadn't quite gotten to burnout yet where you just quit everything.
I've been involved in a lot of good work at the church. That doesn't mean that they were.
I'm sorry. Let me just revel in this moment for a second. let me put the point on that I'm trying to put on so that you can see this. This word intrigued me, and it occurred to me, you're not likely to get overcommitted unless you're responding to calls for service that are coming from other people. Now, let me pause for a minute. Do you buy that? Not too many people come up and say, here's a job that needs to be done, and I'll do it. Here's another job that needs to be done, and I'll do it. Most people who end up overcommitted hear about a need for a job be done and say, well, I guess I could do that. And, well, I guess I could do that too. Well, I guess I could do that as well. Right? And so the question is,
if you become overcommitted, there's about six steps here, so stay with me. If you become overcommitted because you're responding to all these calls for service, where are all these calls of service coming from? They're coming from other people who think there's work that needs to be done of one kind or another. Okay? Is it coming from the Lord? Our church has been working real hard for probably more than a decade now. I don't think in terms of the culture of this church that we're there yet. But I think we're working towards getting to a spot. And the spot we're working towards is a spot where everybody is involved. And involved as God would have us involved. In things that God calls us to do. Using our gifts, using our passions in that service. So, what happens if somebody says, well, this needs to be done, puts out a call for service, and nobody responds? What conclusion should we draw? I don't think we're here in our culture yet as a church. But what should we conclude if a call for service goes out and nobody responds? Maybe that shouldn't be done. Now that is hard. What if you had a heart for Caritas and you put out a call and there wasn't a response? Maybe that's not what we're supposed to do this year. Now, I think you have to temper this with about six or seven different thoughts. One of which is, if you look at a church and a year goes by and nothing's ever done by anybody, there's probably something wrong. But if you're constantly burning people out by doing, or having a few people who do all the work and everybody else kind of sits back, that's not right either. There's a big enough church here that if everybody works where they're called, then the things that God is calling people to do will get done. And so if an opportunity comes for service, this church, its official documents and its official policies are that we're asking folks not to say, oh, that's something I could do, but to explore, is God calling me into that? And if you're not sure, go try it out for a little while. See if your gifts and your passions and the opportunities are matching on that. And I think for watching that week of Caritas, I think I was over there three nights. There weren't very many people there who didn't want to be there. There weren't very many people there out of a sense of obligation. They seemed to be there out of a sense of service. And I think most of us walked out having gotten at least as much as we were able to give. That's the kind of service it ought to be. It's very interesting to me that T.W. Hunt put this down as a perversion on this particular one. Found that very interesting.
I think you need to add devoted to the middle list.
Please note again, that's another word that could show up over there next to bullheaded stubbornness, but I think you're right. If you are not called, and maybe that's a word I would put down, responding to a sense of call, and then devoted to the Lord to being looking for such calls. I think that's the way that works. Now, there's one more thing I want to explore just a tiny little bit. It has to do, I think, primarily with these two. My brother's an accountant, and I'm not. But I do have work to do. And if you were to ask me what I do, my answer would be I teach. But I'm teaching very specific things. I'm teaching people how to be a scientist. I'm teaching them how to think like scientists. I'm teaching them to work like scientists. And I'm teaching them how to be that. And I see some things in common between what my brother does and what I do. And one of the things that I work real hard with my students on, and real hard with me too, whenever you're doing research, you get an idea of what has probably happened in an experiment that you've tried. And then you collect evidence and data, spectroscopy and other kinds of pieces of information. And you go look at that to see if it supports or doesn't support your idea of what happened. Man, it is so easy to look at the data and rationalize, oh, that's what happened. And we've got a rule. If there's a single piece of data that does not line up, we stop. We don't publish that. We try to find out what it is that doesn't make sense there. And we have saved ourselves so much trouble by that rule. Because sometimes we found something odd is going on that suddenly opens up. It wasn't happening the way we thought, but what was happening was much more interesting, and it opens up other doors of that. But here's the thing. When you have accountants, they're reporting to people. And those people may have either job opportunities or raises or promotions or advancements or whatever hanging in the balance of whether or not what you report the person likes. This week, God willing, I'm going to go to Tennessee and I'm going to try to get an appraisal done on my mom and dad's house. We needed to get it done last year. For one reason or another, it didn't get done, so this is the week we hope it's going to get done. Have you been reading in the newspapers as I have the last month as I've thought about this coming? I've been noticing the business pages have had probably 4, 5, 6 articles about housing appraisers in the United States. Have you been reading these reports? The housing market is starting to fall just a little bit. Okay? And so people who are trying to get a mortgage, real estate agents who are trying to get something sold, bank trying to get business done, whatever, they'll call an appraiser and they'll say, I want you to go appraise this house and here's the amount I want it to be worth. And if you come in with an appraisal that doesn't make that, you're not going to get any more business from that bank. And the feds are trying to crack down on this. Do you see the problem with this?
The key here is in honesty. This seeking knowledge becomes linked to this, in my mind anyway. That I'm looking at what I know, and I'm trying to be honest about what I know. Which brings us back into the context of 1 Corinthians 4:2. We're stewards entrusted with the mysteries of God. What's expected of stewards is that each one should be found trustworthy. That is, what is it that I hold? What am I supposed to do with this? I'm supposed to be a witness. I'm supposed to be a worker. Part of that is finding out what... If I'm not careful, I'll fall over here. Cults are out in here. Perversions of all kinds. Denominational split-ups are out in there. Because people aren't staying true to what's back here.
So, it's an interesting tightrope to walk to say... As best I understand it, here's how things are, as opposed to, this is how things are, you better believe it. I'm left very cold by the second of those. The first of those, that's somebody I enjoy listening to. Ravi Zachariah, some of you know him. I was listening to him this week. And he comes to one point and he says, I've been studying about Solomon. And I found something that I think is significant. And then he says these words, I'm not sure, I may be wrong, but I think there's something here to be looked at. And now here's what he says. He is the only king. He's the only king reported in Kings and Chronicles who does not have a prophet interacting with him. I love the way he said, I may be wrong. This may not be significant, but I think it is. What does that do? That invites me to think alongside of him and see what I think. And then he says, I think Solomon was so wise in worldly wisdom that he thought he didn't need to have anybody holding him accountable. And all of his problems came from that. All the other kings, whether they listened or not, had a prophet sticking the finger in their face saying, you got to measure up here. And so he says, are you a Christian? Do you have somebody who's ready to hold you accountable in the way you live your Christian life? If you don't, you might fall into that other trap. Faithfulness, I think, hinges on something like that. Not just, am I accountable to God? Have I put myself under the authority of a brother or a sister to give them the right to put a finger in my face and say, you better think about this. And open my life up enough to them where they know what's what. You listen. The people who are strongest spiritually, I think, the people who are strongest spiritually seem to have that as a feature of what they do. Some of you are doing that for each other in small groups and other kinds of places, and I commend you for them. Okay, there's more that I could talk about. I think I've got just about enough time to do one thing. This is the first time I've done this, and I may be a while before I do it again. But I want to do something that I think connects to this. It connects to this as the very last piece of what I'm about to do. I'm going to do about 8 or 9 things, and when I get to the end, we'll close the circle and we'll be back where we are now. All right? One of the things T.W. Hunt does in another place in this work, and it may not be in the workbook at all, he talks about something that he calls the complementarity principle. And that's a big word for something that's actually fairly simple. And here's what he says. Our Lord has a role that he plays. And we are required or expected to play a role in response to his role, a role complementing his role. There are things he does in his role, there are therefore things expected of us in our role. Ready for the first pair of words? Jesus is our shepherd. What are we?
Sheep.
What is expected of a shepherd? Somebody else said it.
Protect.
Leader, later on in this list, is the one that guides. This one is guards. The shepherd is a guardian. If we are sheep, then what should our response be? What are sheep supposed to do? And stay pretty close to the sheep. Nope, because that goes with leader. That fits better with leader and what would the complementary word be? Follower. It's to depend, yes. But here's what T.W. Hunt said. These are making me think, and I'm sharing them with you. T.W. Hunt says, the response of the sheep, what's expected is growth. Growth. The shepherd guards so that the sheep can grow. Now, the other things you're suggesting, depend on the shepherd and so forth, those are beautiful things. And to think of the shepherd as guiding, to mix some of these up a little bit, I think that's great too. But listen to that. The sheep are expected to grow. What do you have sheep for? Somebody said rack of lamb in the first hour.
Lamb chop.
What? Wool. Right? You grow the wool, you shear it, you grow the wool, and you shear it. To the extent that that metaphor works, the shepherd provides guardian, the sheep respond with growth. Isn't this interesting? I've got about 8 of these. Let's see. The next one is father. Child. So this to include you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay? What does the father provide? I just gave it to you. The Father provides. Father is the provider. What's expected of the child? And I'll tell you, I broke a heart or two in my first hour. What's expected from the child? Here's T.W. Hunt's word. Relationship. There's a person sitting where Leonard is sitting now. Her son turns 50 this week and she has no way to send him a birthday card because she doesn't know where he lives and he hasn't talked to her in years. Fathers and mothers provide. What is expected of the children is a relationship. And if you've ever had that relationship strained or broken, you understand how fragile that is. Isn't that interesting? Third one. Elder brother. That's Jesus. What are we? Younger brothers, younger sisters. What does the elder brother provide? This is powerful. Example. He used the word model. Model or example. What's the response expected of us?
Emulate.
To mirror. To mimic. The word he used was resemblance. He is our elder brother. We are his younger brother, younger sister. What is expected of us? To mirror, to mimic, to emulate, to resemble. Teacher? Student. He says disciple, but it works the same. The teacher provides. Interestingly enough, provides information. Knowledge. They provide instruction, but the essence of instruction is to provide knowledge or information. What's the responsibility of the disciple? To learn it and to apply it. To learn and apply. I can remember very clearly, I guess it must be 18 years ago, we had two students in our senior class, both applying to graduate school. One was a nearly straight A student, Phi Beta Kappa, just wonderful grades, applied to North Carolina. North Carolina gave her this wonderful scholarship, it's going to pay everything and more. The second student applied to North Carolina, middle B, something like that, struggled for everything he got. North Carolina said, no, I don't think so. We picked up the phone, called North Carolina, said, you took the wrong one. There's a difference between book learning and being able to walk into the lab and make the chemicals begin to do things. We call that good hands. You get me some student that's got a good work ethic and willing to learn how to do those things. That first student, tremendous book learning, but was almost afraid of doing the reactions. Well, we convinced them. They did take him in at the sort of lowest level. 3 years later, they called us up and said, you know, you did us a good favor there. And he was about as good as they had by that point. Leader and follower. Leader provides. This is the time to do what you did back on Shepherd. Guidance or direction. Guidance or direction. Follower. Now, this is another one that I found interesting. What's the follower supposed to do? Follow. Right? But here's what T.W. Hunt says. Follow is sort of the easiest thing to say. The leader is supposed to lead, provide guidance. The follower is supposed to follow. But here's what T.W. Hunt says. Know his steps. You can't follow if you don't know where he's leading. The way God leads is by providing us as in his role as teacher with information, which includes directions. And sometimes those directions are such that we can see, maybe not all the steps, but we can see the next one or two. Master, servant. The master provides, the master plan. Or at least that's as close as I can get. The master is the planner. So what is the servant expected to provide? Another very interesting way of wording it. I circled this one, it was so interesting. Obedience. Isn't that interesting? Obedience. We're almost there. Vine. Vine. John, chapter 14, chapter 15. I am the vine. You are branches. The vine provides nourishment. the connection to the source, or the vine is the source. Okay? What's the responsibilities of the branch? Think John 14 and 15, and it isn't producing. You're close, but he uses the word out of the book of John. I am the branch, you are the, I am the vine, you are the branches. What is it that you're supposed to do? Do you remember the word? Abide. Now, conduit doesn't work if you're not connected. Connected is a word I would use. And this is the point where those of you who've been in here a while will have heard me say this. We are not batteries to go to the Lord and be filled and then go out and use our power wherever. What are we supposed to do? Extension cords. And that to me is what the vine and the branches probably better communicate to our age. We're now at the last one, and I want it to come full circle. He is the bridegroom. The church is the bride. The bridegroom provides. I hope this isn't hard. Love. And the bride responds with
faithfulness.
Isn't that pretty? Isn't that beautiful?
Would you say
bridegroom provides love, and the bride responds with faithfulness. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, we thank you that you are our shepherd, our Father, that Jesus is our elder brother, that the Spirit is our teacher, and that you in three forms, in three persons, are our leader and our master and the vine, and that as the bridegroom, Jesus gives us love. Teach us how to respond with growth, by being related to you, by mirroring and emulating what we see Jesus do, by learning, especially learning the steps that you're leading us to, with obedience, with connectedness, and with faithfulness. Go with us in the week that is to come, and if it's your will, bring us back together next week. We ask all this in your Son's name. Amen.